And very good morning out there, everybody. This is Dr. Andrew Dyer joining you live in the studio today. And I'm just making a few quick adjustments here. I am with you live this hot Saturday morning in Dayton, Ohio. And it's a pleasure to be here because we have a number of great topics to discuss today. And I've planned out a few of those in a particular order, but this is live radio, so anything can happen. Also here and available to take your phone calls. So if you have a question that you'd like to ask me, please give us a call here at the studio. The number to reach us is 937-457-1290, and we'll be happy to take your calls and move forward from there. So without further ado, let's dive into a few of the topics of the week, because our job here today is to not only give you some expert analysis on the maybe the articles of the week, some things you've certainly seen out there on the internet, things that have been reported. And one of the articles I came across this week was a really sad state of affairs for the teen and preteen age group in our country. And I say that's a sad state of affairs because if we don't address it now in this population, the 12 to 17-year-old group, then how unhealthy will they ultimately be at age 30 and beyond? Because the headline that I'm alluding to is stating that 1 in 3 teens have prediabetes. Okay, so prediabetes is affecting 1 in 3 teens, and that's new CDC data is showing that as of July 8th, so just a few days ago. And what is the real risk in the prediabetes group is that if the tide doesn't turn, then these patients will all become type 2 diabetics. And I say they will become because 90% of them have it within their power and their wherewithal to make a change now, to adjust what's coming into their body in the form of fuel as food, basic level supplementation, and some other characteristics, notably getting up and moving. Getting up and moving, not just planting yourself in front of the TV or the video games all day long. And I'm specifically talking to that 12 to 17 age group, because that's the crux of this article, is that if we don't do something about it now, we're going to be in for some big trouble in about another decade, decade and a half. And so what the CDC data is showing and what it means is 8.4 million young people here in the United States, or 32% of that U.S. adolescent population, had prediabetes in the year 2023. And that's actually the most recent data that's been available for analysis. So we're looking backwards in time now, 2 years, and seeing and knowing that these numbers are way, way up compared to where they should be. And I'll tell you that over the last 2 years, we haven't gotten healthier. I mean, there's no data to prove that. It's coming. But it's not there yet. So with the prediabetes moniker, not only do we have high blood sugar levels, higher than normal, but we're just slightly below that threshold for type 2 diabetes diagnosis. So it's not a glucose value that determines this. Yes, glucose is part of the overall assessment, but really we're looking at a value called hemoglobin A1C. And if you're a diabetic patient, you know that number all too well. For a healthy range individual, it really shouldn't be higher than 5.6. But to be inside the diabetic criteria, it has to be above 6.4 to truly fit that category. So what does that mean? Well, prediabetes then falls somewhere in that interim, right? Above 5.6, but not above 6.4. And what is the hemoglobin A1C? Well, it's a 60 to 90 day average on the stability of the sugars within your blood. So it's simply taking spot shots in time over that span of time, the 2 to 3 months on the calendar, to determine your risk or how well you're managing that condition, or whether or not you can reverse it altogether. And I've worked with a lot of diabetic patients. In fact, on our website, take2healthcare.com, you can find a number of my case studies there. And that's underneath the resources tab. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 spots over from the left. And then you scroll down 2 or 3 slots and you find case studies. When you click on that link for the website that we have put together for you, that's where you see a lot of our cases. And we described to you, of course, the age of the patient, where their numbers were when they came in, what their diet was like at that time. And then put together some of the key facts on how far they can come, sometimes in as little as 2 to 3 months. And that's a pretty short snippet of time if you're considering someone who's been on Earth 60 plus years. If we can get their health turned around and recovered within a 60 to 90 day time period, that's pretty good. I mean, that's pretty fast in the grand scheme of things in the 60 plus years they've been around. Now, back to our teen population here. Separate from the new data among teens, new diabetes diagnoses among adults have also stopped decreasing after more than a decade of decline. So about 1.5 million new diagnoses were made in 2023 for adult diabetic patients. And this poses certainly a significant threat to our longevity and to really just being able to live in a healthy way, because after the route of diabetes is discovered and then managed medically, the longevity factors don't increase. In fact, they decrease quite dramatically after that diagnosis is made, because with that problem of diabetes becomes the other issues that maybe aren't going to show up for 5 or 6 or 7 years after the diabetes diagnosis. And that is poor circulation affecting fingers and toes. Maybe it's neuropathy. Maybe it's actually tissue change to the point where there's consideration of amputation of these joints of the feet primarily. Because if a diabetic person can't get their sugars under control, they lose that capillary performance. And the capillaries are those tiny little blood vessels at the very end of our circulatory system that feed new nutrients and get old used up blood out of the tips of our fingers and the tips of our toes. And if that system isn't working properly, that's where you start to see the effects. Among other things, we see a slowdown or a reduction in metabolic rate for diabetic patients, meaning they can't easily control their weight balance. And what is one of the common causes of diabetes? Being heavier than you ought to be, being over that ideal weight threshold. Now, I was having a discussion with a patient this week, and he was actually getting set to refer his wife into our practice. And he said, you know, I think, and he started off very carefully, but he said, you know, she's in her middle 60s now, and she's having some hormone problems, or at least he thought they were hormone problems. And he said, she's struggling to lose weight, and I think it's her metabolism. I said, okay, well, that's an interesting concept. I think you're probably right to some degree, but we won't know until we have tests back. But what does it mean when we say it's their metabolism? What does that mean? How do we test it? How do we figure it out? Well, in short, there's no real way to do that. But in a longer, more broad assessment, there's a number of little signs that we can see within a very comprehensive blood profile that'll give us some clues on whether the metabolism is functioning optimally or just really slow in its progressive action of keeping our weight and sugars under control. So there's not a number. If we were looking at breast cancer or diabetes or anemia, there's a set of particular lab values that will answer that question for us. Does this patient have this problem? Yes or no? Those are really clear-cut, easy to define. Well, if we're looking at metabolic dysfunction, that's a great social media buzzword. Everybody's out there reading about metabolic dysfunction right now, but we really have no clue how to define it because it's encompassed under a number of different subsects in the body. So we're talking now thyroid function. We know that's in charge of some of our basal metabolic rate. So how quickly we burn through the fuel that we're taking in as food, partially controlled by thyroid. It also hinges on how healthy our gut is in terms of good microbiome. So microbiome are the bugs that live in our gut, the good ones that we need to have there in order to break down our foods and actually produce vitamins and minerals for us. Majority of vitamin K in our body is produced within the gut by the microbiome, those bacteria and bugs that help us do that. B12 is produced in there as well, and a number of others. Those are just some of the common buzzes of the day. But if we're thinking and looking at how healthy a person's body is from a metabolic function standpoint, we also have to assess the gut. So we're looking at thyroid, gut health. What is the immune system doing? Because in part, metabolism is in charge of how quickly we burn through fuel in the form of food, but it's a whole lot more than that, because the food that we put in as that fuel becomes other parts within our body. And the food that we eat becomes protein. Well, it is protein. If we're consuming high protein levels, we have to be able to break that down. But then we have to be able to turn that protein into something useful for the body. And that typically happens under two formats. We use protein as energy, and we use protein to run and develop new white blood cells so that we can fight off infection and other foreign invaders. So if we're putting together this large umbrella of what falls underneath the category of metabolism, all those different systems beg to be checked. Now, there's a couple of other areas we haven't even mentioned yet. Drugs. And when I say drugs, I'm not talking about street drugs. I'm talking about prescription medications. What possible prescription medications is that potential patient on that is altering their metabolic function? I have a whole list of different features and functions that we're going to talk about on the other side of the break related to some of these medications and how they alter that balance of good bacteria in the gut. And I know most of you are thinking right now, just like I was when I found the article, it's all blamed on the antibiotics. Yes, antibiotics do crush a lot of the bacteria that we have in our gut. They're designed to work that way because they're killing the bad stuff, but they're also killing the good ones too at the same time. But this is actually a much more far-reaching article than I had even imagined. It goes through and talks about some of the chemotherapeutic drugs, some of the drugs used to treat heart conditions, the statins for cholesterol, and some of these other big classes of medications that I remember hearing about and learning about how they did alter that function of the gut and the bacteria. But now we have some solid laboratory research behind which particular bacteria are harmed. And then more importantly than that, what can actually be done about it? What can we do to make that better if we have to depend on this medication, even for a short span of time? So metabolically, again, those medications that we take, specifically under the categories of depression, anxiety, some of the psychological medications that are used to govern people's moods and emotions and regulate things that way, those have a huge connection in slowing down metabolic rate. I read an article this morning that said they only attribute certain drugs in this category to about 4 pounds of weight gain, but they never defined the timeline on that. So if you're getting 4 pounds of weight gain every 60 days and you're on this medication for 2 years, and I've seen this in my practice, that adds up to a lot of extra weight over time. And it may not be that that drug can just be exited from the system, but if we get your body healthier, would you need as much and for how long? Rolling up on our first break here. We're going to take that break right now. You're listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer live this morning on WHIO, AM 1290 and News 95.7. And we'll be back right after this. And good morning. We are back again. This is Dr. Andrew Dyer with you live this morning. And I'm filling in for Dr. Merkel, of course. And I've been here now for 20 years. 20 years, well, this September will be 20 years, and it's been a pleasure and an honor to be here behind this microphone to be able to bring some expertise, some knowledge, some food for critical thought over the last couple of decades. And before we dive into the article I was alluding to on the other side of the break, I wanted to give you just a little bit of quick feedback on the diet that I was talking about related to some of the potential reasons why this adolescent group is really struggling with their health. And it's a really quick and short synopsis, which is a beautiful thing for live programming. Eating highly processed foods impact muscle quality, found a recent laboratory study. So diets high in ultra processed foods are actually associated with higher amounts of fat stored inside the muscles of the thigh in the human body, regardless of total calories consumed or physical activity level. So even if they're a young athlete that's doing a lot of running, training, swimming, whatever kind of muscle activity they're doing, it doesn't change the fat deposition into those global movers of the body located in the thigh muscle when we're eating those highly processed foods. And that's a significant finding because higher amounts of intramuscular fat in the thigh could increase the risk for knee osteoarthritis. What's the most common orthopedic surgery done as our aging population continues to want to be as active as possible? Knee and hip replacements. knees probably outrank hips, but knee and hip have got to be right there. If knees are 40 or 52%, then hips are 48%. I don't have the stats in front of me, but that'd be a pretty close guess. For lower extremity surgeries in the 60-plus aging population, that's it right there. The use of natural and minimally processed ingredients in many of our modern diets has decreased in favor of ingredients that have been industrially processed, artificially flavored, colored, or chemically altered. So just a couple of quick examples of this: breakfast cereals, margarines and spreads, packaged snacks, hot dogs, soft drinks, energy drinks, candies and desserts, frozen pizzas, and ready-to-eat meals, as well as mass-produced and packaged breads, include these synthesized ingredients and are highly processed. So what can we do instead? Well, we have to teach these younger preteen, teen, and young adults how to choose healthier options. And how to choose them can be quite easy. It's just, how do we prepare them? How do we keep them around? How do we keep them from spoiling? Well, one of the habits of eating a lot of fresh fruits and veggies is you have to go to the store more often. You can't go to the grocery store once in a month and stock up on all these fresh things and be able to eat them all before they've spoiled. That's part of the hazard of it, but it's also part of the beauty of it. Even changes that I've seen over time in the last 20 years, if you buy a piece of fruit, like say a lime or a lemon, and you're going to use it in cooking or other kitchen activities to flavor things or to help pre-marinate chicken, things like that, these fruits last a long, long time sitting on the countertop. And some of that's good, some of that's bad. Some of that's due to GMO production and hybridization, sorry, tough word. But those are some of the processes that we have to look for and watch for as we're selecting fruits and veggies. So if we choose an organic lettuce, we need to use it within 2 to 4 days. If we don't, it'll still be there in the fridge 7 days later. It might smell a little funky, but you could still eat it. Most of the time, it's going to be okay at that level, but it's not a high-quality food anymore. It's lost a lot of its nutrient density. And if you're choosing an iceberg lettuce, it's basically devoid of nutrients anyway. You need something green, bright green. The brighter, the better. Higher nutrient level anyway. So the article I was teasing about, and I know we have another break coming, but I'm going to give you just a few little thoughts to consider. More than just the antibiotics, antipsychotics, immunosuppressants, statin drugs, these are the huge classes of medications that people get put on, and they're disrupting the health of your gut on a level of destroying some of the good bacteria down there that we count on for vitamin production. So we're going to dive much more into the details on that when we come back on the other side of the break. Also have a couple of call lines open. If you want to give us a call, 457-1290 is the number, and we'll be standing by. You've been listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer this morning on AM 1290 and News 95.7 WHIO. And we're rolling back into it. Thank you very much. Dr. Andrew Dyer standing by live here with you at the studio, and we're going to dive into that article I've been teasing you about since the beginning of the program. A lot of common drugs are on this list. A lot of common drug classes are on the list. And it's not as simple to say that only the antibiotics, the antivirals, the antifungals are the ones that are causing gut, the fancy medical term is dysbiosis, but what it really means is imbalance. Okay, imbalance of the gut due to loss of those good bacteria that are required for so many things, not only vitamin and mineral production, but keeping our bodies on a low level of inflammation rather than letting high levels of inflammation exist. Some of the bacteria do that as well. And they help us not only digest and absorb food and move it through the gut tract, but use that power of digestion to fuel our systems. So our gut has to be strong and functional. The new buzzword out there now is that the gut is the second brain. And that's a fairly strong leap to make, but the connection exists in that if our gut is healthy, it makes our brain work better. And this makes sense because the fuel and food that we extract from what we take in the gut goes to fuel our largest and heaviest organ first, which I know is actually the skin, but in this case, I'm referring to the brain. So the brain is our most influential organ. It's not the largest and heaviest, that's the skin, but the brain, the skin, the heart, the liver, the lung, and the kidneys all require that first line of get nutrients out of food, put it into the gut, and then let the gut sort it out as far as pushing it off to other places where it's needed. Proton pump inhibitors. That's a whole class of drugs designed to do what? Reduce heartburn. Proton pump inhibitors reduce heartburn. But how? Well, they change acid production pathways. And in and of that mechanism, that can imbalance bacterial concentrations. Because when we pull down acid levels too far, then the food has a tendency to sit there longer and rot and ferment and actually backsplash up and can create more heartburn, because simply we require some of these acids to break food down and move it through the gut. And when that balance is altered, then the function isn't as good. NSAIDs are on the list too. Laxatives make sense. Why? They affect the gut. Chemotherapeutics, statins, immunosuppressants, the list goes on. But the interesting one that I found too, and that I talked about a little bit earlier, was the medications used under the antipsychotic heading. So meds that are influencing how our brains work, and make no mistake, there's a number of people out there that can certainly benefit from these medications. It makes them more functional, it makes them more useful in society, it makes their life better. But on the flip side of that, there can be side effects associated with that. So what can we do to make that part better? Well, there's actually a test. And one of the articles I read earlier today said, well, testing is too expensive and it's difficult. Well, it's actually not that difficult. And in the grand scheme of things, it's not that expensive. For about $400 or $500, in between that price point, we could do a complete digestive stool analysis within our office. We don't conduct the testing in our office, but we order it. Patient takes a stool sample from their home, wraps it up in a laboratory container, and sends that into the lab in Chicago. We happen to use a lab in Chicago for this testing. And they will give us back, in about 1 to 2 weeks, they will give us back probably a 25 or 30 page report with all the findings that they were able to gather from what came out of your body. And it's not that difficult to do. And it gives us a ton of great information. Some of the info in this would boggle your mind in terms of what they can find and what they can highlight is going on in your system. And then giving me as the practitioner and clinician some opportunities to influence what's happening there with particular treatment options. And those change, of course, depending upon what the test results show. Not everybody gets treated the same way. Probably got 100,000 different combinations of how to treat that, with a variety of things, dosages adjusting for the patient's age and height and weight and other vital signs. There's all sorts of ways that we can impact what's going on there. And so to just put it into a laboratory study and say at the end, well, testing is hard to do and it's expensive, you don't have to stop there. You just have to find somebody who's willing to do it for you or help you get it. And that's where we could come in. I've talked before on this program too about the topic called inflammaging. And if we have a little time at the end, we're going to come back to that and kind of summarize a few things. Because what we started the program, or what I started the show with today about the pre-diabetics in the teen population, really comes full circle when we're talking about our senior group of patients. But to take a little break in between those two, there's a great author from Los Angeles. He's a DC like me, and he writes on a bunch of different cool topics. And I read his article every time that I get the chance. But he did a 4-part series on how we as DCs, so doctors of chiropractic, especially those of us who have advanced training and board certification in clinical nutrition like myself, how can we help our current US population achieve one of the greatest goals from an ill health perspective, and that is cardiovascular health. Why do I say it's one of the greatest goals? Well, it's the one that affects people the most. It's the number one killer of American patients currently, more than all the cancer diagnoses combined. It's cardiovascular health. So heart attack, stroke, hypertension, all underneath that category. But this article is really to the crux of how can we focus our efforts, not only with the patients that we get to see, but how can we train even their families and their kids and their neighbors how to do a better job with the foods we're consuming and the lifestyle choices that we're making to make inroads in this condition? Because if you look all the way back to the 1940s era, the American Heart Association has supported, this number was staggering when I read it, almost $6 billion worth of cardiovascular and stroke-related research. $6 billion with a B. $6 billion worth of cardiovascular and stroke-related research. And still, what remains as the number one killer is heart disease. Stats on this. Someone in this country is dying of cardiovascular disease every 34 seconds. So since the time I've been covering this article, maybe the last 3 minutes, we've lost six people. Six people. Due to something that in most individuals could have been at least prevented, changed for the better, or pushed further out into the future. Every 3 minutes and 14 seconds, someone suffers a stroke in the United States. We have work to do. Standard medicine uses drugs, stents, and bypass operations, none of which has anything whatsoever to do with the cause of the illness. It is simply a reaction to what they have found in previous presentation by that patient or that patient's test results. It does not get to the cause. And I think if we focused our attention on it, we could make some huge impacts in our nation, as well as even around the globe. But we have to be a leader. We're trying to move that needle. And we have seen many marked improvements. Since the 1950s all the way up to 2021, there was a push from the AHA, the American Heart Association, to look at smoking cessation as one way to make the heart healthier. And that has absolutely been of benefit to the grand population. Quitting smoking is one of the most challenging things to do, but best things to do for overall heart and cardiovascular health. I'm going to tell you about some options that you have on that. If you've tried to quit smoking before and have been unsuccessful, I do smoking cessation acupuncture in our clinic and have about a 95% success rate with that. It will take 5 visits. You will be off cigarettes or your vape box within 2 weeks. But you have to decide you want to do it, because the needles can't make you stop smoking, but they can affect your brain chemistry in a way that your cravings and other sensations that drive that habitual use of those devices or those cigarettes to change for the better. So we will give the American Heart Association big props on helping the public know about the dangers of tobacco use, because that goes a long way in helping to prevent heart disease. But there's more to it. The second big public health implementation is around blood pressure control. But since the 2020 pandemic, blood pressure control in this country has gotten considerably worse. And the population at large needs help. And they need help managing it. They need help detecting it. We call high blood pressure or hypertension the silent epidemic, because in many people, there is no overt sign or symptom that you're having high blood pressure. You don't know until you test your blood pressure. You're not always walking around with a headache or always walking around with a finger that turns green. There is no sign that says, oh my gosh, your blood pressure is way too high. But if you look at the numbers and follow their trend, it's not good enough to walk into your medical doctor's office one time, get a high blood pressure reading, and get put on medications. It's not good enough. Now, if your number's way, way, way too high, then of course you might need something to bring it down. But you really need to look at a 7 to 10 day progression of what the numbers look like. Even 10 to 30 days would be better to give us a trend to work with. Because what is blood pressure supposed to do? Well, it's supposed to change based on the position of our body. So laying down, you get different numbers. Sitting, you get different numbers. Standing up, you get different numbers. That's how blood pressure is supposed to work. Why? Because if blood pressure doesn't change for those positions, we faint and fall down. That's called orthostatic hypertension. If you can't positionally change your body and still have good blood pressure control, that's a problem. It's a diagnosable medical condition that could indeed be improved with proper nutritional support and testing. Now, is it good enough to just say, if you have high blood pressure, you need to lose weight? No, because I have plenty of patients in our practice that have come in already near or at an optimal weight, and they're taking blood pressure medications. They don't need to lose weight, but they need to get healthier. It's not always as simple as you're too heavy, therefore your heart's working too hard, therefore you have high blood pressure. There's dietary concerns and risks, there's habitual things like smoking, and there's how much do you exercise? And when you do exercise, how hard are you pushing yourself? How long are you going? And then when are you checking your blood pressure after you finish? Typically, what the reports say is if you check your blood pressure within 2 to 3 hours after finishing exercise, that's when you should get, in theory, your best reading of the day. Now, for different people, that threshold of time slides a little bit. Maybe it's 1 hour after, depending upon the kind of exercise, you get better numbers, or 4 hours after for others. Somewhere in that 2 to 3 to 4 hour window after you've finished exercising and have sat still and quiet without talking for 5 or 10 minutes, that's when you're supposed to get your best blood pressure reading for the day. How many of you do that and then go see your doctor? No, that's difficult. The timing wouldn't work. I mean, unless you had a 2 o'clock in the afternoon appointment and you're not working that day, you go exercise from 9 to 10, you sit still and quiet for the 15 minutes before you arrive at the doctor's office. No, you're driving in rush hour traffic and you're breaking your neck to get there 2 minutes late. And then you have high blood pressure and you wonder why. Well, it's not always as simple as that day's problem. This is a complicated process that's been building up for several decades, but there's ways to help. And again, it's not as simple as reading in the literature and saying, well, I need garlic, I need CoQ10. Yes, you probably do, but you really need to be tested and see what's going on. We're going to take a break right now. You've been listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer this morning for Take 2 Healthcare, your guide to better living on WHIO. And thank you very much. We're back. The final few minutes here. Have a couple of questions to pose to you, the listeners out there. And if you've had the chance to listen to us before, thank you for that. If today was your first time joining us, also appreciate you tuning in. But just a few things to consider. What if testing your blood every year could catch health conditions before they became a problem? Common diagnoses we talked about today, like diabetes, cancer, anemia, and others. Would you sign up for that? Would you want to know? Would you be able to take action to change the course of your health for a better, brighter, and healthier future? Well, of course, as you know, in our clinical nutrition practice, that's exactly what we've been doing for the past several decades. A famous quote from Thomas Jefferson goes like this. He said, "Doctors of the future would not concern themselves with the pathology of disease, but rather would care for the human frame with diet and nutrition." At the time that he was making these statements, he didn't know how that would hold up over the next 200 or 300 years, but it has, because at that time, diet and nutrition was modern medicine. It was modern medicine because we relied on our food and other options from the earth, things we grew, things we consumed, how we did that. That's what kept us healthy. And just being put on medications does not make you healthy. Okay, it depends on how you define the term healthy, but healthy is far more than just the absence of disease. And really, if you think about it, if you have diabetes and you're put on metformin, that doesn't mean you have the absence of diabetes. That just means you have your diabetes under control. Well, if you changed your diet, lost weight, got yourself fit, got up and moving every day, and you actually dropped your A1C down below 6.4 without medications, that means you got healthier. So there's a big difference in how we define and consider that term for how it can really be applied. Well, if this food for thought strikes a chord deep within you, then you may need my help or someone in our office. That's myself, Dr. Yaley, Dr. Merkel. It's Dr. Yaley and I that are now seeing all the patients each week, but Dr. Merkel's here giving us guidance and performing radio shows and helping to educate doctors around the country. But I wanted you to know that you have options. No matter where you sit today with your health, whether you're on 6 different medications or no medications at all. Are you as healthy as you want to be? Are you as healthy as you could be? Well, those are only things that you can answer for yourself, but with the help of someone who's trained in the art of clinical nutritional assessment. And it's not an art, it's a science. Okay, there's a difference. Okay, it's a little bit art, but it's mostly science. And the art part comes in knowing and having experience under your belt to know when things aren't going exactly according to the plan that you've seen work for others, how can you make modifications to help that patient that's right in front of you now? I did that this week. Had a patient reach out to me on our system, our email, private email server, and she asked, well, every time I start adding in these couple of additional supplements, I get a gut warning that goes off. Now I get loose stools, I have other problems, other issues. And she said, what could I do? And I suggested, okay, well, stop for a moment. Stop adding new ones and actually stop and take yourself off everything for just a short time. Let's rebuild the gut. Let's focus on balancing those good bacteria in there. So I gave her a couple of different probiotics to take just by themselves. And I saw her in the office yesterday morning and she said, thank you very much. And it was great. I mean, it was an easy thing, but unless you have experience or testing in front of you, you don't always know exactly how to do it. And do we get it right every time? No, but we try. And if we don't get it right the first time, we'll get it right the second time. I know that because we rely on a system that works very, very well and has helped a lot of people. So thanks for tuning in this weekend for Take Two Healthcare. I've been Dr. Andrew Dyer this morning, and you'll be hearing us again live next Saturday on WHIO.